From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in secret Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Alan Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are player count and hidden information. But we're not going to hide it from you. We're going to talk about it. So if everyone's ready, let's start. I did the same joke twice. I like previewed that joke.
Yeah, we would have laughed at it if we hadn't heard it before.
That's generous. Yeah. You didn't really laugh at it the first time.
You weren't supposed to tell the listeners that.
It's good to be honest.
So, Stephen, you have warned me that your topic is big today.
Potentially, yes.
So we should probably get to it as quick as possible. But we have a couple things to talk about first.
Yes.
First thing I want to talk about, I started playing with this utility, this this asset for Unity called the Forever Engine, which is a way to quickly make endless runner games.
Okay.
Making an endless runner is not that complicated in terms of what you need to do, but there's a couple of best practices that like you find your way to if you do something like that. And This engine sort of has it all built in for you. It's really, really good. Nice. It works for both 2D and 3D. It can extrude 3D terrain, so you can have much more randomization than just creating different segments.
Very cool.
Really interesting. And you know, we were talking about in the last episode about learning things. This is a thing I got into recently, partly because I had this idea for a mode and widget satchel, which I told the two of you about a couple days ago. But it has some utility in the main project I'm working on right now, and so it's been kind of fun to toy with. And it's been a little while since I've gotten a Unity asset or like a third-party library that I really expected to use. And this one's pretty nice. So I thought I'd recommend it. Unity had this big, buy a million assets for $20 kind of sale. And that's how I got it. I was just thinking like, well, these all look good. In worst case scenario, I'll have given 10 cents to a lot of developers. Because it's always like 90% off these things. Mm-hmm. But this was one that looked really cool. So. Cool. Having a fun time with it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and just like how it structures, it's basically like object pooling is all it really is. But it's interesting thinking about like how all the trouble we had in Widget Satchel about like reusing components, and that was all the levels were designed, but we still had to have a system for like managing all of that.
Yeah.
To eliminate overhead, and just thinking about how I wanted to do sort of endless style levels in that game originally, but it was way beyond scope at the time. Yeah. And so that's one of the reasons why I sort of was like, oh, this would make it a little bit easier if I wanted to get back to this sometimes.
So. So how far are you on the endless widget satchel now?
I will say I kind of put together a little prototype of it.
Oh, really?
Using the components from widget satchel. Yeah. So it's doable. It's just a matter of if I have any time to do it.
Right.
Yeah. The answer to that is no.
Has that stopped you before?
No. The problem is that I come up with like a fun name for it, and like I imagine what it's going to look like and how it's going to work, and then I can't let go of it.
Yeah.
It's like a dog with a bone. So like it would be, it'd be a new update to Widget Satchel. It would be the endless mischief mode. Like,
yes,
how could you not want that to exist?
I do want it to exist.
I know, right?
Mark,
I haven't even detailed it here on the show, but trust me, it will be fun.
It is. Yeah.
Anyway, I don't have time for it, but it was a fun little diversion. I got to learn a new thing.
There's always hiatus.
There's always hiatus. Oh, it's so dangerous.
Violate stuff on the hiatus.
I did give myself an item on the list that said stop adding items to the list. So that
and yet.
I haven't added it to the official list.
Right. Okay.
my life meta update is I think I've permanently lost my husband to Magic the Gathering.
Oh, Eric, we hardly knew you.
He came home last night. He was hanging out with friends all weekend because I guess there was a release of a new deck or something. And a lot of the decks these days have been like D&D themed, which I really adore. Mm-hmm. He came back and comes back with a stack of cards and this stack of sleeves and this book. And he's like, I got to do this. You want to help? And I was excited to help. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so we watched TV and we watched Star Wars. At least I got to choose what we watched. We watched Star Wars Rebel. Not, we watched the seventh season of Clone Wars, and then we re-sleeved a bunch of things. And he kept stopping the show, like pausing the show. I have to show you this card. Look at this card. This is going to synergize with this thing. So we'll get him back in a few months.
Yeah, are you sure you won't just get lost in there with him?
I'm not going to pick up Magic the Gathering until I've beaten Metroid Dread.
Okay.
And then also Hades.
All right.
I commit to this.
We've put it down on tape, so
I solemnly swear I will not.
Ellen has her hand up.
Yeah. I don't think there's enough. I do find Magic the Gathering pretty fun to play, but I don't think it's enough to suck me in.
Yeah.
So, probably not.
Okay.
But,
well, but we'll check back. Let us know when he gets back and we'll have a welcome home party.
Okay. You made it.
Steven, you had a thing?
I do. Movie theaters don't want you to know about this, y'all. Yeah.
It's one weird trick?
It's one weird trick.
One weird trick.
It's not weird. It's just, okay, so you know how movie theater popcorn tastes differently from the popcorn you cook at home?
Nope.
Yeah.
What? What do you mean, no?
What do you mean,
no? You already know this trick?
It's just popcorn.
I'm going to let that slide, Mark.
Okay. Mark is wrong. Please continue. Okay.
I mean, I worked at a movie theater.
Yeah, that's true. You did. Also, then you might know this trick already.
So Mark's popcorn at home tastes like movie theater popcorn.
Is the trick just salt?
No, it's not just salt. It's a specific type of salt.
Oh.
It's Flavacol. It's not actually salt, I think. I think it's just some kind of
It's
weird.
Like dust.
Yeah, basically. It's
yeah,
just dust.
Yeah,
yeah. It's like a yellow powder thing, almost. I found about this thing on the internet or whatever, and I bought it, and I put it on my popcorn, and it tastes almost just like movie theater popcorn. So I'm never going to a theater again. Because that was half the reason I went to a theater.
Yeah, that is true, popcorn. Yeah. You'd always get a big bunch of it, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's funny because
movie theaters do very frequently in their promotional materials, mm-hmm. they talk about how great their popcorn is.
Yeah.
And I always just thought that was just a thing they said because, like, that's a thing they say. Like, I never thought it was actually a claim they were really making.
It's a claim.
But I guess it is.
Yeah, it's real.
And it's just that salt dust.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's that. And they probably use a particular kind of oil. I think I need to get a different oil to act.
Right.
Accurately matched.
And then you need to put it in a container for like 3 days. Like, warmed up. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. That'll
make it a little stale.
Yeah. A little stale.
Not just the popcorn, slightly. The oil.
The
yeah.
oil.
And yeah. then it's butter, but maybe
just
it's
the heating
butter.
Element, just passively keeping mm-hmm. it a little bit yeah. above room temperature.
Perfect, perfect. That's the trick. That's the trick.
Well, okay, you're gonna have to put this in the show notes then, so that
Flavacol. It's just Flavacol.
Yeah,
that's the name of it.
You say that like it's a real word.
It's not, but yeah. Well, and also it's surprising. Like the package mm-hmm. looks ancient.
It probably is ancient.
It looks like it's from the '80s.
It's not like a consumer product. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's designed.
I think so. Like, so I bought it off of Amazon, but like
yeah
you can.
It's meant for commercial.
I think. Yes.
Right.
Yeah,
so it doesn't
need to
have a great logo.
It gives you a big. It's basically like it's almost as big. It's a little smaller than a milk carton, mm-hmm. almost. But like you only use like a teaspoon of it every mm-hmm. time you pour the popcorn. So like you can buy that and you'll have it for years.
Huh.
So that's great.
My headcanon right now is that all of the what was this called again? Flavacol.
Flavacol. Yeah.
All of the Flavacol that has ever been made and ever will be made was made in the '80s. So like, there's a stash.
Yes. That's hilarious.
You have to like go into the warehouse and use your security code.
Or just call Amazon, I guess.
Well, it's their warehouse.
Yeah.
All warehouses.
Right,
they're
Amazon.
Amazon
was just expanding and then just like the warehouse just had all this stuff in it. And they're yeah. like, well, okay, I guess we're selling it now.
Yes, score. We got a whole stockpile of Flavacol
oh,
in this
that's
one.
So good. Okay. Should we get into it?
Yeah. Well, okay.
Oh, wait, I have a transition.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Well, we had three meta topics.
Yes.
It took us like 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Which one of those numbers, 3 or 5, is better?
Ooh. Ooh. Mark, you care to answer that?
Well, if I know anything about which number is bigger than the other number.
I said better, not bigger.
Oh, I see. Then I really couldn't judge.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that didn't really work because like, I hoped it would. What's your topic, Mark?
My topic is player count. You were trying to get us to 4 somehow, is what you were trying to do.
Well, you have 3s and 5s in this list as well. It starts out with 4. There's a lot of 4 in this list.
Yes.
I'm curious to know why 4 is such an important number here.
That's the question. That is something that this topic is inspired by an article that that I read recently. You, listener, may have read it as well from Polygon, where one of their reporters interviewed a bunch of developers and asked them about, like, why is 4 the number? Why is 4 the number for multiplayer games? And what was interesting to me is I was thinking like, oh, there's lots of reasons, and I'll get into those. That's why I chose this topic. Mm-hmm. But the article kind of started with this question of like, why not more than 4? Why only 4?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this person's probably 15 years younger than I am and doesn't know like where 4 came from.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, probably isn't totally unaware, but thinking of it in terms of the online space.
Right.
Because it's in recent years, four-player online games have become a lot more popular. I would say 10 years ago, you didn't have a lot of those. There was there were like 16 and 32, you know, character map. Like that was what online multiplayer was, lots and lots of people. Mm-hmm. But four-player co-op games, four-player team games, four-player competitive games, 4v4, you know, or 2v2, those kinds of games are online, are pretty popular online now. And there's a bunch of examples of online games that have four. And the that game Back 4 Blood just came out, which is a spiritual successor to Left 4 Dead, and both of them have the number four in their title.
Yep.
And they are four-player co-op zombie shooters.
Yep.
And so this article was really interesting that it asked a bunch of people about this, and the answers that they got, we'll put the link in the show notes, so I won't recount all of it, but it's a really good read. But a lot of it is four is a good number for a team. You can give people different abilities. You can class them out. Mm-hmm. But you do, it's not so many that you have to come up with really unique things for five or seven different types. Okay. It's just kind of a magic number. Mm-hmm. Larger numbers can work better for like autonomous actors. So people that are all working together but don't have to communicate with each other.
Oh, okay.
That works pretty well.
Sure.
But when they all need to be part of a team that does things together, four is kind of like a max in a sense. That was the opinion of some of these developers.
Okay, I could see that.
But one of the other things that came up a lot in the answers to this, which is what I was thinking about originally when reading the start of this article, was that four is an established number.
Right.
Right? It's familiar to people. A lot of these online games are also playable local. Mm-hmm. And who has more than four controllers at home?
Right.
Right? And that was really one of the answers. Like we didn't want to do more because we didn't think people would ever play with more because they would have no opportunity to.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is that they didn't get to the bottom of it. They just was like, it's four is the number. It's the number we're familiar with, and that's the number. And so we chose it.
Yeah.
But then also they go on to kind of get at a couple of other reasons. But a lot of times they talk about that weight of history. So I did want to talk. That's why I came to this topic, so actually talk a little bit about how we got there, and how some of those reasonings, I think, when they say like, oh, Mario Kart had four, and you know, and GoldenEye had four, and that's why four persists. But it's kind of not necessarily. It's a little bit of it's a shortcut to what the answer we'd all arrive to anyway.
Yeah.
So it's not. That's my theory is that four came to it from lots of technological reasons, but the reason there are four ports on a Super Nintendo. Or on a Nintendo 64, rather, and the reason those multi-taps had four, you know, and arcades sort of mostly maxed out at four, there were a couple of higher ones, is because four is a good number.
Yeah,
not
okay.
purely for the technical reason.
That
now,
makes
sense. We may have the momentum of history behind us to continue picking the number four, but I think we would, if we said, you know, we don't need to be, you know, chained to the past, we'll do our own independent study and find out what the right number is, I think you'd come up with four.
Yeah.
That's my theory. That's my hypothesis anyway. But yeah, so starting out in arcades, the idea of like multiplayer games, two and four, those are the numbers, right? A four-player arcade cabinet was not altogether that common, but anything more than that was exceedingly rare.
Yeah.
I think the only one I ever played was X-Men.
Sure.
It had six characters.
Oh, yeah. Well, and from a logistics standpoint, like six people standing around an arcade cabinet is hard.
Those X-Men cabinets were three television screens that were stitched together.
That's right. I know what you're talking about.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, also, you can have three couples on a date.
Yep.
Ooh. That's true.
But even the four-player ones, a lot of them are actually tied to IP with four characters. So Ninja Turtles, Simpsons, those are famous four-player arcade games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's four characters in those IP, and that's principally the reason why those are four-player games. And so two was just much more common. Mm. Partly because, two people could fit around a cabinet much easier.
Yeah.
Because there was a restriction on the literal size of a screen.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why if you see a four-player arcade cabinet, it fans around a smaller screen usually, or in the case of X-Men, a couple of these stitched together and themselves fanned out a little bit in order to sort of, it's very interesting stuff. Anyway, but so there's some things to get from that, but when consoles started, there are no, as far as I understand, other than like the very earliest like Pong consoles, every console could have two players. That was like a fundamental idea, like because multiplayer games were so common in the era of arcades that I don't think it was conceivable. Like the Atari 2600 had two controller ports.
Yeah.
You know, 8-bit computers like the Commodore 64, those would be the only examples you'd see with one joystick port, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Computer games were one player very frequently, but arcade games, a lot of them were two players. So that's kind of started out with two. But pretty quickly, you'd have what's called the multi-tap, which is like a fun phrase. It's like you're tapping into like a tree or
yeah.
And
yeah.
The multi tap was a way to split off the signal and you'd get more.
Oh, that's the... So I'm familiar with multi tap from PlayStation because they had multi tap things because the first PlayStation only had two controller inputs.
And the PlayStation 2 the same.
Yes. Only had two. So they had multi taps where you could, you know, you'd plug that in and then you can have four players.
Right. Well, that's where it comes from.
I didn't know that. Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's cool.
Yeah, so it split off the signals, and actually the technical the way this worked technically is really interesting. If you ever want to look it up, it's beyond the scope of this thing. But it was pretty early. The original Nintendo had this as well. There were not a lot of games that supported it, but four was a number that like people wanted to get to. The one exception, I find this so fascinating, is the TurboGrafx-16 had a 5-player multi-port, multi-tap.
Yeah.
And the game I know that supports it is Bomberman.
Yeah.
And I know that because the Wii Virtual Console, one of the very first Wii Virtual Console games when the Wii came out, was the TurboGrafx version of Bomberman. And you could, in fact, play with 5 players on the Wii. The Wii only overly supported 4 Wiimotes at a time, but it also had 4 GameCube controller ports.
Oh, that's right.
So you can play 4 Wiimotes and a GameCube controller, and you could play 5-player Bomberman on the Wii. I always find that so fascinating.
That's pretty great.
How it just supported it.
Yeah.
So a couple and a throuple.
Yeah,
basically. Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Or 2 couples and 1 lonely 5th. So, but that's unusual. 4 was pretty common. Now, is that just because it's twice as many as 2? Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like a lot of this interacts with the technology and game design conversations really are intertwined.
Right. Yes.
And I think that I do think they reinforce each other rather than one being dependent on the other.
Sure.
Again, that's my hypothesis.
No, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because like, I mean, you certainly would have whoever like is developing games in the conversation when you're developing a hardware.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, and there's a kind of if it's a multiplayer game where it's like a last person standing kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then 5, there's not a lot of narrative drama to 5. The first person drops off, there's still some more people left.
Yes.
The next person drops off, oh, now it's getting interesting. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think 4 is pretty good for that. So there's like many different reasons why 4 is kind of a right number for a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. And some of them are technical. Like it's hard to, if you're going to do split screen multiplayer, 5 is not practical.
Yeah, where's the 5th player?
Right. In fact, 3 has been a challenge when you do 3-player games.
It's true.
Some games will give 2 players a corner of the screen and 1 player half the screen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some will leave the 4th corner of the screen empty.
Yeah.
Like there's different solutions to those odd numbered things. So there is definitely technical reasons why this is true. But I think a lot of it is just that it does feel better in a sort of a design and narrative sense as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the Nintendo 64 is what popularized 4-player gaming. Which is interesting because I don't think there were any 4-player... Wave Race was a 4-player... I think it was 4 players.
Yeah.
A launch title for Nintendo 64.
Okay.
But Mario Kart, I think, is the... Mario Kart 64 is, yeah, I think what is what people remember most. And GoldenEye, yeah, of course. GoldenEye. Those are the 2 games that I and many other friend groups my age played.
Yeah.
That sort of standardized that. And then, yeah, there were multi-taps for PlayStation and PlayStation 2. Mm-hmm. But I think Halo multiplayer... on the Xbox, mm-hmm. the original Xbox, did as much to cement the idea of a 4-player split screen.
Yeah. For sure.
Certainly for people who who are experiencing their first wave of nostalgia now. Xbox just celebrated its 20th anniversary. A lot of their branding is talking about that.
Oh, God.
But yeah, Halo had, I think, 2-player co-op, split screen co-op, and 4-player multiplayer. And that was before Halo was an online thing.
Sure. Yeah.
They had that as well. So that is something that I think a lot of people remember from their college dorms and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that number is just really important. And what's interesting about it is that it's very much tied to this local experience. But online games constantly trying to push past that.
Yeah.
Because you didn't need to worry about split screens. And so it was just all about the technology. Like, how many people can we get concurrently on a server? More and more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a game called MAG.
Yep. Remember that? My brother was just talking about that the other day.
And it stands for massively.
It's like massive arcade game or something weird.
Yeah. Massive action game.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Just the most dumb.
Yeah.
But how many players was that? Like 128 or something? This is always a binary 128 number. 128
or something.
Reason.
It was always a
binary. It was a very, very high number. And that was its principal thing. It was boring to play.
Yeah.
Because they didn't leverage that mechanic.
No, they didn't. Yeah. They just made it like Call of Duty, but too many people.
Yeah, the idea was that you would have people who would be more of a general role. You'd have much more differentiation. You'd have strike teams that go ahead. You'd have recon teams.
Yeah.
Much more. But people didn't want to play that way. Mm-hmm. Voice chat wasn't as a mature a technology. Not everyone wanted to use it.
Yeah.
And MAG was a PS3 game. So yeah. it wasn't a PC game where people are usually a little bit ahead of the curve on that stuff.
Right.
So it didn't do that well. But I remember myself being kind of excited for it, even though I didn't love online shooters.
Yeah.
I liked a lot of that concept, but it just fell on its face.
Right.
But the idea was to get more and more and more and more and more. Mm. And I think that only recently in these past couple of years, I was like, we have enough now.
Yeah.
We can have as many players as we want. That's not a back of the box feature anymore. Mm-hmm. So what is the right number? And we're back to four. And I think that kind of, that's the best evidence I have for my hypothesis is that when given a choice,
well, you know, I think,
independent of any other considerations, so, okay. We do tend to go back to that.
So here's my question then. Why four? I mean, I'm going to answer the question.
Okay.
Two. I think if you think of it in terms of like from a logistical standpoint, when you start having too many people in the thing, like you were saying earlier in the thing or early in this topic, Mark, mm-hmm. like if there's too many people in the team, it's hard to coordinate those many people.
Yeah.
You know, they end up splitting like too thin.
Yeah.
Too thin.
Yeah. Especially in the kind of time frames where you need to make decisions in games.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. Right. You need to make it quick. Yeah. You're not going to have, if you start having 10 people on your team, it's going to devolve into chaos.
Right.
So like four is a nice number for that, but why not like five or six or three? I think it's just also a nice number for the amount of people that you'd want to play a game with in general. Cause like you want to try to get as many people. I just think about like times when like I want to play a game online with a bunch of people. I oftentimes it's difficult to get more than four people in a thing that like requires commitment.
Yeah.
So like, I think, you know, once you start hitting little higher numbers, like six, it's hard to like imagine trying to get six players to play a game regularly. I feel like that's a tough ask a lot of the time. I know that like Overwatch, I think, is a six player team game, right? But like,
well, a lot of the team making is one friend groups will schedule this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it's how D&D happens.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's how you get more than four people playing D&D.
Yeah.
But very frequently, and Ellen, you probably have more experience than either of us on this, is four players is a pretty good party size. Mm-hmm. And so you have a five player because you have
the DM.
Master. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like games that are asymmetrical, like that game Evolve, that was 4v1.
Yes.
Not 3v1.
Right.
Right? Because it's like it's the four is the sort of unit of
four is the unit of team. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes.
And because what can happen with four is that four people can split off and do two things,
mm-hmm.
and it could be one person could do something and three people can do something, or two and two.
Yeah.
Five people can do the same,
yeah.
but more likely, five people will do two things and there'll be one person left over.
Yes.
Right? And so, and I mean, it's a third wheel, fifth wheel, it's that kind of idea, is that you can, if you have any sort of task that be done by one person, then the other thing to do can be done by everybody else. And then if you have a team of seven and you have four tasks ahead of you, that's still, that divides pretty well.
Yeah.
Except that's just too much for a team to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, right? This is interesting too.
Cause then like, you start needing middle management.
Right. This is interesting too. Cause even outside of cooperative and thinking about competitive games, like I'm thinking about Smash, where Smash Ultimate has eight player on all of the maps. Yeah. I know that like Sakurai had tried to get eight player in like Brawl back on the Wii, but like it just didn't work out. Like the Wii wasn't technically advanced enough, I guess, or something.
Well, can't you do that with you plug in four GameCube controllers and four
not on Brawl.
Okay.
You could do that in Smash 4, only on certain levels, because certain levels don't. I think the technology still wasn't quite there yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just imagining like times when I played, you know, five player matches with people and stuff. Like oftentimes when you're playing a four player match, it will oftentimes split into, you know, two 1v1s.
Yeah.
And then it works out as like you're doing two combats and then like the opponents will swap and stuff every once in a while. Sometimes there's big old, you know, brawls that are just everybody. Mm-hmm. But like it oftentimes feels split. But in like a five player match, you know, you'll have a 1v1 and a 1v1v1.
Yeah.
That's less, it's more difficult to manage that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It becomes more chaotic, which, you know, can be fun, but it's less, I don't know, but it's different. I guess the experience is
there's
different.
Always a case of because you can hit two people at the same time with an attack.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's generally not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a fact of at all times you're always in a state of somebody's outnumbered.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's just an odd even thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's a little bit to that. I think I'm trying to stay away from that. I mean, I think that applies here.
Okay.
But I think I'm trying to stay away from that as being like the reason why it makes sense is because it's divisible by two.
Oh, yeah. I'm not even arguing against like arguing that it because it's divisible by two, it works. It's just like.
But I think it is a factor.
It is a factor, yes. Yeah. But I think that like also logistically, I think it just works better. I think because like if there's one person left out of Rawls, if there's one person, they can just pick up all the items and junk. I don't know. It just it doesn't quite work as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just more chaotic.
Right.
It's just different.
For that specific game.
That specific game.
Yep.
Yeah, for Smash specific. Yeah.
But I do think you're getting at something where, I mean, like the game play is a factor in making it behave that way with an odd number of players. Mm-hmm. But overall, I'm thinking of the way that this intersects with like teen psychology.
Okay.
Because, you know, in our past conversations about Scrum, I think we've talked about like the ideal team size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And with a Scrum team, your ideal team size is like anywhere from 3 to 9 or something like that. I think it's actually 5 to 9. And the reason for that is because you want a big enough team to be able to do the work, but a small enough team that you can actually have like really strong communication channels between individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which boils down to that number two, right? Like, mm-hmm. But with a game, unlike a software development team, you need to form quickly and you need to perform quickly.
Right.
So because you are needing to form quickly and perform quickly and you don't necessarily exactly know what the task in front of you is going to be, like you might know that you have to go, you know, like defend the thing or what, of all the different games that we just made an example of.
Yeah.
Race the stuff. I don't know.
The bullet points in the back of Ellen's game is defend the thing, race the stuff.
Yeah.
Race the stuff, defend the thing. Shoot the guys.
Win the game.
Win the game.
Shoot the guys.
Anyway, right. So we were talking about Scrum having an ideal team size of around like 5 to 9, right? But that's an ongoing team. You're working with those people every day, 8 hours a day, potentially. Right. Whereas with a game team, even if you're gaming with your friends, mm-hmm. like you have a much more fast-paced challenge that you need to deal with.
Yeah.
And so to me, it makes sense that the ideal team size would be smaller.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's not... I think there's a larger variable there.
Mm.
It's not just speed or immediacy. Think about the right number of people in a meeting.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
I think 5 is like the top before it starts to get, well, then someone's not paying attention or someone's not participating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it is that when you're focused on one thing, I don't think speed necessarily has much to do with it, but a team size for a project that you can break that down individual tasks and parts and components and they intersect with each other.
Yep.
But each one of those, maybe you don't want the whole team working on.
Right.
That's true.
Right. So a game is a gameplay session is, so that's kind of why you have some multiplayer games where they have more players, but then they're devised in such a way where it's 4v4 or 4v1 or something like that.
Yeah. Interesting. So like the idea that you're saying, basically you're saying is visualize the game task as a cake.
Yeah.
This isn't actually how cakes work, but it works because we're visualizing a cake. I said cake, you're visualizing it.
Yep. It's too late.
Yep. So you're saying basically like if you cut the task up in pieces, in more than 4 pieces, then everyone's like, this isn't enough cake to engage me.
But at the same time, it's also someone could just go like, I'll just take 2 of those slices. Because I can handle that.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yep.
And then the whole balance is thrown off.
Yeah. So if you think about in a meeting, when you have 7 people in a meeting, then 2 people can find their way to not paying attention.
Yes.
Or not necessarily that they're zoning out, but they could find their way to just being the observers in that mm-hmm. meeting,
right?
And not being part of the meeting, which actually I will say is fine. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean a failure of a meeting.
Right.
But in a game,
if
there's 4 players, so that's enough division of labor. Regardless of what the game is, that one person can like take it easy for a moment.
Yeah. Right?
But it's not so much a division of labor that one person could just hang back and just observe the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. 3 is probably perfect for that. And that basically all 3 people have to be on at all times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ideally. I mean, I'm seeing very abstractly, it's different from game to game. But 4, I think, is just enough flexibility so that people can kind of ebb and flow their participation and engagement. And trade tasks and stuff like that, but at the same time they do have to be present the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right? More than that, and then you don't have to be. And you can design a game that's suitable for that.
Yeah.
Right? We were talking about MMOs and raids and stuff in the last episode.
Yeah.
That's a case where you could take 30 people into a raid, 15 of them can just be along for the ride. That's mm-hmm. fine. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a suitable player count for that experience. It's, yeah. That's kind of okay. But a lot of games don't want that from their design.
Right.
And so I think that's I think it's probably why 4 works for that.
Hmm.
You know? And why 3 is kind of like everyone wants to make a 3-player game. Like, I feel like everyone has that, like, like, that's kind of like when you're deciding for the 4th role is kind of the hardest one to come up with.
Yes.
Because it's like one more than you have any ideas
I'm
for.
I'm absolutely glad you brought that up because that's something we struggled with Vengeance.
Mm. But 3 is so much harder to balance.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Which is why I think people go to 4.
Well, and it's just a weird number. 3 just feels like a weird number.
Yeah.
Right? It, well, at least with respect to this, like, I'm going to grab my 2 friends to play this game. That feels, I mean, it's not that weird when you say it, but it's like, it feels weird, though.
Well,
right?
I mean, here's the thing. It all goes back to that sort of engagement and balance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Here we are, 3 people on this show.
Dang, that's true.
Right?
Yeah, there are 3 of us.
When we have a guest host, when there's 4 of us,
yeah.
You can usually go back and see that one person usually hung back, or
yep.
At least hung back for a big part of it, and mm-hmm. more 3 other people. Now, that works pretty well,
yes. Mm-hmm.
But we can't do that every week. So right. 3 is the right number for us, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know, there are great 2-people podcasts, but then both those people have to be incredibly engaged.
Yeah.
The 3 of us, we all have to be on all the time, mm-hmm. but we can share the load a little bit, but it's not casual the way that 4 can be.
Yeah.
And that's what you want from a game, is a little less stress.
Yeah.
A little less.
Or the option of having less.
Yes, but yeah. not the option to opt out of the
exactly.
experience.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
We've had 5
yeah.
people on the show a couple of times, mm-hmm. and that's been difficult
yeah.
for that reason.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard to manage a conversation.
Yeah.
It is hard to manage a conversation. You've got, because you have so many people at this point. You can, like, we talked about this earlier in different contexts, but you can start to have individual one-on-one conversations splinter off.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Whereas you can't really do that with 4. It's too it's too dense.
And that's the important key, is that that's not why you should always do 4 for your multiplayer game. It's that if you want to do a number other than that, you need to design for it.
Yeah.
And in a way that you may not expect at first.
Yes.
Right. Right. A lot of what we've been talking about is stuff I had never really even thought about being a factor. But of course. I mean, and these kinds of things, like, all the way come down to factors that I never would have expected. Like, how big is your living room? How comfortable are right. you seating so yeah. many people in your living room? Mm-hmm. You know, like.
Yep. And here's the thing. If you think about it, living rooms are the size they are for the same reason.
Yeah.
Right? Is it that you don't generally have more than 4 people in a room at a time?
Yeah. Well, and that it's probably, I mean, that would even be dependent upon culture.
Yeah,
like,
exactly right.
You know, like, that's. People have, you know, people in different cultures tend to have different bubbles.
This goes yeah. deep.
Yeah.
And so that's why that's my hypothesis is, yeah. is that we think of this 4-player thing as very a lot of technological constraints, but all of those are driven by these same factors.
Yeah. Like, more psychological right. and yeah. social. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly right. I mean, it's like why tube televisions settled on around the size they were. You know, in terms of, like, the mass market of them, they were,
yeah.
They weren't 10 inches. They weren't 30 inches, even though you could build them that size. They were 20 inches
mm-hmm.
because people could gather around that size.
Yeah.
And then that would still, I mean, TVs are much bigger now, but in the arcade days, like, that was a reasonable thing for people to get around and still be mass market, affordable.
Did yeah. you, like, design all of this stuff based off of the idea of the atomic family?
I mean, it very much could be a lot of that. I mean,
and
the atomic family is a similar, a social unit.
Yeah.
And so it's not the same exactly, but sure. in terms of, like, number of human participants. And again, Ellen, you brought that, bringing up, like, different cultures. That's really good element of it because it's all about the culture.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
so thinking a lot about sort of, like, you know, our Western culture, like
yeah.
that sort of that. Think about your closest friends. Like, you have like 10 close friends, but really you have 3 or 4 of mm-hmm. them you're super close with. And so, and little groups or subgroups, and it, a lot of times it does, 4 is kind of the average of all of that.
Yeah.
Right?
Nuclear family.
Yeah. That's what it is.
I like
atomic, right now. I mean,
I really like atomic family, so we should come up with something new for that.
Sounds like a TV show. Maybe because I'm thinking of Adam's yeah. family.
So nuclear family is a funny phrase, and it gets mixed up a lot because it's very associated with 1950s and the atomic era.
Ah,
but
yeah.
nuclear, because you have you have the father in the middle, and you have the ions and children.
Oh, is that why
rotating around that? It's a nuclear component.
Yeah. Oh, that's
a like nucleus, proton, a, okay, yeah, nucleus.
Yeah, so it's okay. It's sort of it's cultural and it's gendered in a way that has its history, but it's easy to mix up with atomic, not just because the words sound similar, but because we associate it with like Leave It to Beaver in that era, right?
Worthless tiny electron children, I guess. Like, pretty much, yeah. And you never really know where they are.
Yep. There it is.
You know where they're going and where they've been, but you don't know both at the same time. Right. Hey, folks. Xmas is coming.
It is.
Crimbo. What? We call it Crimbo.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's for another time.
Yeah.
If you've got folks in your life who listen to the show or who are game devs or game dev curious, we got a great gift for them, which is the Nice Games Club t-shirt.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Tell us about it, Steve.
It's so comfy, y'all. It's got our logo on it. You know our logo. It's so cool.
Right, and that alone is comfortable.
Yeah, it is. Just think how stylish you'll look walking down the street with this dang logo on your shirt. Mm-hmm. Like,
underneath three layers of of wool and jackets. But you know it's there.
Maybe our listeners are in California. and yeah, it makes for a great gift because people are gonna look at that and go, "Wow, this thing is so cool."
Yeah,
you're gonna knock your family, friends, significant other's socks off.
But also, it is a very comfortable t-shirt. It's very soft and nice,
which is great if you're gonna come up on holiday season and you're giving lots of hugs to people.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Then you know you'll peel off your layers and they're like, "That's a cool logo." Yeah. Give me my hug. And give them a hug. And like, that's a soft shirt.
Right.
And I mean, you've got some close friends, you might haven't seen them in a while. They all just got their booster shot.
Yeah.
And maybe you think that you're comfortable, you can hug them.
Mm-hmm.
What better shirt to do it in?
Oh my goodness, it all comes together, y'all.
Okay, well, we're overselling this, but it's a really nice t-shirt, and you should buy it. It's got our logo.
Yes.
And it supports us. Yes. And you can get it at nicegames.club/shirt.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
I don't know how to transition into this topic. Martha, take us in.
There's a lot of stuff I don't know.
Well, that's because it's been hidden from you.
Really? Yeah. Someone chose to hide it from me?
No, that makes it sound really bad. Maybe that is the case, though. I don't know.
Steven, she's trying to help you with this transition.
I know, I'm not. Now I'm sitting here having a conversation. Hidden information is my topic. Hey-oh.
I would have taken you all the way there. But
I know. You could have.
You had to close the drawer and shove me out of the car.
You pulled that Martha all-purpose ripcord real quick.
I did, because I was like...
No face.
Steven, that is for emergencies only.
All of my topics are emergencies. fair enough.
I mean, if someone's hiding information from me, I do want to know, and I do want to know now.
Yeah.
So why would someone do this, Steve?
That's a good question, and that's what we're here to discover. So my topic is in information, obviously. I wanted to talk about this not just from a player perspective, but also from a dev perspective. Like, a player might have information that other players don't have. They might want to keep that from them, or they might want them to figure it out. I don't know. A dev will have information that is hidden from all players,
And maybe the dev wants them to find that out eventually. Maybe they don't, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's different ways to implement this concept of hidden information. Examples I wanted to bring up. So like from the player perspective is like the idea of the fog of war. If you've played World of Warcraft, not World of Warcraft, just Warcraft. Or
that's what it says. Just Warcraft. Just right on the Warcraft. Box.
That's it. That's all you get.
I mean, certain things are hidden on the map in World of Warcraft.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Warcraft or like Civilization 4X games oftentimes have this concept of fog of war where you can't see what your opponents are doing, and especially in a 4X game, like when you spawn on the map, you can't see what the map looks like yet. So you need to explore the map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From the player perspective, it is in your interest to keep that information hidden because like you want to build up your armies or to, you know, hide the fact that you don't have an army or whatever.
He's on to me.
Yeah. Another example, I think a popular card game is called Hanabi. It's like you're like the metaphor is kind of weird where like, you're like building fireworks, but you're really just trying to like get the right order of cards.
Yeah.
Correct or something.
The story is you have to put on the most epic fireworks show.
Yeah. But like as a player, you have your own hand of cards, but your teammates do not know what you have in your hand. You're not allowed to tell them what you have in your hand.
Right. And then cooperatively you're building a deck together. Yeah.
So you need to try to communicate that information without fully communicating that information based off of the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
From a dev perspective, I'm also going to bring up Fog of War. Mm-hmm. Such as, you know, a 4X game, because like, you know, players have to explore in order to understand how the map looks and things. So it is in the dev's interest to like hide that information so that they do explore. Another example might be this board game called Betrayal at House on the Hill. We looked this up. It's such a weird name. And yeah. I feel like whenever I say it, I get it wrong. Where like you both actually really the dev and the players don't know who like the monster is going to end up being or what the monster is going to end up being. While they're playing the game, but like the dev has, you know, prepared a whole set of scenarios.
Yeah.
And that makes it exciting and interesting when that reveal happens.
And not knowing is vital to enjoying a game like that.
Exactly. Yes. Right. So
because like, you make gambles, you go this way because of your intuition or because of the little information you have, you like that. And it was a horror themed game that's important to the experience of enjoying it.
Yeah. So like, I think there's a lot of like things that hidden information can provide for your game, and there's just like a bunch of so many different directions and reasons as to why you would do it, and I'm just gonna attempt to disseminate some of those. I mean, us as a group are going to discuss it hopefully, because I am not the end-all be-all information for this. I don't have it. Somebody needs to provide me the hidden.
He's not hiding anything from us. Not he's right. Gonna give it all.
All that I have.
Yeah,
so one of the goals is to just get the players to play the game a certain way. So I brought up 4X games. And that, like, you know, that idea of exploration. If in the beginning of the game the map was revealed to you right away and you could see everything, there's no reason to explore because you already know what's on the map.
Right.
And I think, at least in like Civilization or Humankind or other games like that, they want to encourage players to explore the map because players like that, for one, and the devs want that. It's good for pacing purposes. So like it can be valuable to hide certain things just so that the players don't, so the players play the game in a certain the way you want them to play it.
Yeah.
Also, you know, discovering exploration, finding new hidden things you didn't know before is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Discovering all that kind of information is exciting. Variety, I guess, just because like as with the example of Betrayal on House of the Hill, you know, you get new every time you play the game. Theoretically, there will be a different monster in a different situation you have to deal with. So, like, that comes into play. It'll be mm-hmm. a different experience each time. I mean, same with, like, Civilization. You don't all, well, unless you pick the same map every time, because you can do that. You don't always get the same map. So, like, exploring can find new things. You can find new, like, natural wonders and junk. Different civilizations that spawned.
Yeah.
Things like that.
And also, like, it's about you keep your options open until it's, you know, it's the, like, a superposition. Like, it could be this or that.
Yeah.
So I need to plan for both of those things being true or gamble that one is going to be true.
Right.
And then when I observe it and then it settles into what it is.
Yeah.
And I find out what it is, then I can, you know.
Yeah, actually.
Like, it's like, I could have, 10 turns ago, I could have been preparing for this. Yeah. But it would have been a mistake, too, because it might not have been this.
Yeah.
And so there's a given push and pull, a risk reward
right.
part of it.
Well, and that's a good point, because like, that's a lot of reasons why like people playing like 4X games recommend you build some army, even if you don't necessarily need it in this moment, because yep. you might need it. Maybe barbarians or another opposing civilization knocking at your door sometime soon, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's valuable to have that kind of stuff. So like it really colors how players play the game. Like if you know, and you can set this in like Civilization and other games too, if you know that there aren't going to be any barbarians in your game, then there's not really a reason to have an army unless your opponents decide to attack you. And I don't know, if you're playing a multiplayer game, maybe discuss that up front.
Yeah.
But like, if you know that, then there's no reason to do that. But if you don't know that, then it'll change how you approach the game. Mm-hmm. Like not having this information can be valuable. I know that like a lot of players like having having all this information so that they can optimize it. But I think that like players oftentimes will optimize their way out of the fun of the game.
Right. Mm-hmm. They're essentially just assembling IKEA furniture at that point.
Yeah.
Which is fun. But
sometimes.
Depends on the person.
Right.
I hate it.
But it's not what the game was designed to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that it's valuable. And frankly, like from a player perspective too, having that hidden information can be valuable too. It doesn't necessarily have to be literally information. Well, I mean, I guess it literally is information you're hiding from the player. But I'm thinking about it in terms of like fighting games too. Like if you as a player know what your opponent's capable of, but you don't know what their plans are until you like start to suss that out as they start, doing actions and things. Mm-hmm. Like I guess you can even know their ultimate goal. I mean, obviously their ultimate goal is to, deplete your health.
To beat you.
Right. But like the way that they're going about it, you can start to figure that out as you like, get that information from you. So it could be like a back and forth spy sort of,
Mutual deduction.
Mutual deduction sort of thing, which is really fun and fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, knowing too much too early burdens you with the need to act on that information.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I don't know why they thought of this, but hidden information is not just games designed specifically for that, but there's lots of little things that you hide from players for their own convenience.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
the one I'm thinking of is in GLOM,
mm-hmm.
when everyone knows what the three things, you get the phrase, the rule, and the goal.
Yeah.
If there's a tie in GLOM, you pull out a new goal card, mm-hmm. and then you judge based on that goal instead of the goal that you drew.
Yeah.
If players knew what the tie goal was, mm-hmm. then they would be thinking about that and designing their phrase
right.
for that, and then a backup for that. That is just too much to burden the player with.
Exactly.
And so that is, I think, I believe that's the only piece of information properly hidden from players.
Yeah.
But it's designed purely as a tie resolution mechanic. It's meant to be a little weird and different.
Mm.
But if we wanted to make it fair, then it would actually just make the game less fun.
Yeah, exactly. Because right? it'd be so too much to think about at the same time.
Yeah,
it's already hard enough.
So, you can have I think like chess is a perfect information game.
Right.
Both players know everything that is knowable, mm-hmm. except for what's in the player's head, right? And so if you have that as an ideology, this game is going to be this way, you still have to, or this game is going to like hide all information from players. It's going to be a total, big mystery all the way through.
Yeah.
Think about to the tiniest little pieces of information, what benefit that is to share or keep from the player, and how that interacts with your main gameplay loops, all of its, all the,
right.
the other mechanics in it. Because it's not as simple as you might think it, even if your game is pretty simple.
Yeah.
Like GLOM is,
I'm glad you brought that up, though, because, I think a lot of information is hidden from player just for their own benefit, and not just to, make them play differently, but also just because, it's not relevant information that they needed.
Exactly right.
So, I can think of, I'm thinking of in Skyrim, and I'm hoping this is the base Skyrim, not just because I modded it. I know that, they won't show you your stamina bar when it's full, because, you don't need to see your stamina bar when it's full. You just need to see when you're, your stamina bar when something has changed about it.
Yeah. Well, see, that's information, though.
That isn't. What do you mean by that?
Like, not showing the stamina bar is giving me information. It's telling me.
Oh, well, cool. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a good point. That's right. But it's not. Yeah. That's a good point.
Right.
That's fair.
So this comes to what I was, when you were putting notes to this.
Yeah.
I asked you.
You did. What is information? Yeah, what is the definition here of information? And dang it, I don't have an answer.
It's
for
sometimes
that,
hard to know, right?
Yeah. That's a good question. Yeah. I want to ask that question.
Relevant data about the game state.
Yeah.
Well, the system.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Relevant, though, I think is the important.
Relevant, yeah. Relevant information.
And it's the communication that is received by the player, not always what's on the screen
yeah.
or what is, you know, delivered mechanically.
Yeah.
It's what is told. And that is through many different ways, more than you probably can even think of when you're building your game.
Yeah, it's not necessarily. Yeah, like, yeah, that's. It's like the note you didn't play.
Whoa.
You heard it here. Game dev is jazz.
That's good. I love that because I love jazz. Yeah, okay. So I'm thinking of another thing that, you know, we. Me and Mark have played recently, and then Ellen will play eventually. Metroid Dread.
Wow.
Just every episode is just an update on you not playing this
game. I'm just going to try to beat the whole thing by the time we record next. I'll be like, and I won't even tell you guys. I'll just try to be like, So how about that end part?
Right. Stuff. See, the important thing about this in relation to this topic is you did just tell us.
What?
That you were going to do this.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, but you know I say things and then don't do them.
That's true. That's also information we know.
And both of those things are relevant. You can decide which one's relevant at this moment.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We actually, Steven, you and I have no idea whether Ellen is going to finish Metroid Dread, even though she has told us that she will and won't.
Yeah.
Electrons.
Yep. So, okay. So the Emmys in that game, there's the machines that like chase you in certain sections of the map.
What?
See, Ellen, in this game.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. That's funny. Sometimes that, you know, it's there that those sections of the map are kind of like weird stealth things that I personally don't particularly care for, but that's not the point. When they catch you, because they're probably gonna catch you. There's like a brief moment where you get like a quick time event where you can get the opportunity to swat the enemy's like attack off of you, and then you get like a few moments of reprieve to run away before they like start chasing you again.
Yeah.
But it's extremely difficult to hit those. I'm gonna hit that point.
And it's impossible to get good at it.
It's impossible to get good at it.
Because it's randomized.
It's randomized. The timing on when you press the button is different each time.
It's explicitly meant for you to not ever get better at.
Yes.
You're just supposed to, you get lucky sometimes.
Right. So that information is hidden from you and obscured from you because it gives you the opportunity, however slight it is, to like, you know, survive that encounter despite the fact that it otherwise will kill you. Which, you know, gives players like a brief moment of hope, of, you know, chance, possibility. It colors their experience of that encounter.
So. Yeah. The player is prevented from turning their attention away.
Yeah.
Because of that tiny slice of hope that they know they're not going to get, but they are compelled to engage with it anyway, which keeps them on edge, that's part of the whole point of that game. Whereas if it was just like a mini game with like a needle going back and forth on a bar, like you could get really good at it if you were like really good at frame perfect button presses,
right?
But that's not what that's for.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, like that, those kinds of things can change the game, and I think that like, understanding what information, frankly, is, and what like how you want to display that information, how you want players to see that information or not see that information can be really relevant to how you're developing a game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm thinking about like sometimes with respect to like Fingence and stuff, I know that like we have augments and stuff. We try to give as much information to players as possible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But like that also made it so that like they would just sit on the shop menu whenever they're picking augments and stuff for forever. And it would make that difficult to make decisions based off of that stuff. So sometimes I would just like be kind of obscure with it or pick big numbers so people would be like, oh, this is a big number of a value I want.
Yeah.
I will grab that.
Right. If you have a complicated system and you give players all the tools they need to navigate it, they will navigate it.
Yep.
But in the case of Fingence, you didn't want them to be like, you don't want them to be the perfect shoppers.
Well, and they don't need to, like, a lot of that information that's the specificity of certain augments, they don't need that information because like it's not super relevant. It's not the important part of the augment.
Right.
Hmm. So like I would just make sure that they got the important stuff.
Yeah.
And not specifically say sometimes we would be like after 3.5 seconds this will come back. But like other times we'd be like it's just a big thing.
Yeah.
Makes a big boom.
Big boom.
And so in Metro Nexus, which is a four player multiplayer battle game.
Yeah.
Four.
Exactly. there are power-ups that you pick up along the way, and it's very simple, and therefore I am able to give players all the information.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that I designed that mode to be a way where there was nothing kept from any players.
Yeah.
You knew what tool the other players had, you knew how many points they had, you could see their position on the screen. It's a perfect information game. I can only do that because that information is quick and digestible and you can act on it at all times.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas a game like Fingence, with a lot of that complexity system that sort of loadouts and the temporal element, and that you're building towards something else. You're pouring your stats into this. Right. Later you'll continue doing that, or you'll switch stats.
Right, right.
It's too much to process at one time.
Yes.
In a way that would be comfortable for four people sitting on a couch to do at different rates.
Right. Exactly, yes.
And so you put in ways to make that go a little faster, either by subtly pushing players towards choices, by making them seem easier to choose, or by taking choices away from them to make them get through the shop faster, and adding a little bit of randomization and a little bit of that sort of, that also adds to replayability and interacts with the other systems.
Yeah.
But there are different techniques, but ultimately in service of the same goal, which is to give players the information they need at the time they need it.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why the names for the augments that I made were very boring. They were just like, name of gadget, effect.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So people would be like, oh, it affects this gadget. This is the effect of the gadget,
right,
or the thing. Cool.
Because the other thing that the shop does in Fingence is it expands the lore of the game.
Yeah.
And so you need to know when to press down on the gas on that component.
Yeah.
On the mechanical.
Admittedly,
component.
I probably could have been more fun with my names.
Can I jump in with an observation?
Yes.
So one of the things that we talked about when we were preparing for this episode was kind of this dual taxonomy that you've described. Like, are you hiding information from the player perspective, like because of the gameplay, or are you hiding information from the dev perspective? And as I started thinking about the last few minutes of our conversation, I'm thinking, oh, well, there are two things, because there are two reasons why you hide information, right? Mm-hmm. One, information is because it's part of the game design, it's part of the gameplay.
Right.
And then the other reason is because you're managing the attention of the player.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And those can overlap. You probably do usually have both.
Mm-hmm. The attention of the player is part of the game design.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense.
And we actually did that in Widget Satchel. So mischief score is we don't surface to players as part of the HUD in the game as you play. You can't do something and know how many points it earns you.
Yeah.
It's very difficult because it's not visually, that information is not given to you.
Yeah.
You can pause the game at any time and see your current mischief score.
Yep.
But we do not give the players the information they need to be able to connect how much mischief score their actions are worth, only how much they're racking up as they go.
Yeah.
And that is explicitly by design, so that they can do a little figuring out. They can see, oh, my score goes up quickly after I've done a bunch of this, but also to prevent them from focusing too heavily on it.
Yeah.
Right? So it kind of has a dual purpose there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just really supposed to reward you for hitting stuff.
Yeah.
And for enjoying the process of hitting things.
And that's the information we do give you, is you do mischief, get mischief points.
Yeah. Yep.
That information is given to you, but then it's we make it impossible to game that system.
Yeah.
And so all you can do is engage with it.
Yeah.
It literally does nothing for you other than you get more points.
I mean,
yes, but you know, some people just want points.
Well, I know. That's what I'm saying. Great, though.
Right, you feel seen. It's like, I like hitting junk in this game.
Yeah.
Yes, we know. Yeah. Continue. Right. Carry on.
But we don't let you optimize it. And so players are never motivated to, because it's an impossible task.
At least not optimizing it based on the numbers involved.
Exactly right.
You're going to optimize it based on the number of explosions.
Right. You can, and that, again, that, because that's what we want people to enjoy, not the points, but the actual mischief.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. But I do think that having the points associated with it is a way of motivating that.
It assigns value to mischief.
Exactly.
But it doesn't assign an actual price tag.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It creates value, but it doesn't create a formal economy around it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dang. Yeah, that's, I love game design.
This is one of those where we're winding down the topic, and we're like, we could do so much more.
I know.
But then we'd have to start over with chapter two of this thing.
We totally would. We'll have to come back, hidden information to Electric Boogaloo or something. I don't know. Yeah.
What's great about a topic like this is just you come up with we talk about any particular game, and we talk about ones we've designed, but also Metroid Dread.
Right.
And you can talk about any one game and the information it gives you and doesn't.
Yeah.
For a long, long time.
Yeah.
There's so many examples. I encourage listeners to think of a game you're working on, you've worked on, or a game you've played, and think about it in those terms and start to drill down a little further than you would than when you play.
That's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and on our programming in general. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at Nice Games Club, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and speeding up compile times. Gotta speed up those times. Or you can email us through contact@nicegames.club. Want to support the show? There are so many ways. Give us a review on your favorite podcast app. Mine is Pocket Cast. That's my favorite podcast app. You can tell your friends about your favorite episodes. You can join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. We have an increasing amount of fan art showing up there, which is so cool.
Oh my goodness. Oh, the Sledgehammer Pride art.
Oh my God. Oh my God, you guys.
I love it.
We love you guys. It's so amazing. Oh, and then there was the hamster in the t-shirt.
Yeah. What you're describing this is like a big community, but it's really one of our most dedicated, really like knocking it out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to tear up. Okay. Also, we're on Patreon. And as a patron of the show, you'll enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Well, I mean, I want to, what time are we at? How long are we, mark that really quick. What time are we at?
We're at about an hour.
Okay. I won't bring up the game that I'm am playing, which is Monument Valley 2.
Ah.
But we could do that later.
Later.
Later. We don't have to do it now.
Okay.
Yeah. Or we could do it now.
Yeah.
I couldn't read your facial expression. You were just laughing.
Well, I'm giving you the choice, I guess.
No, I want to think about it more. But now I'm going to play it tonight, and I'm going to think about it in terms of hidden information.
Instead of Metroid Dread?
Yeah, you've got homework.
Yeah. You said it for yourself, or you didn't. I'm unclear.
It's hard to
know. I won't be able to go to bed tonight on time if I try to play Metroid Dread tonight.
Okay.
Well, that's going to be rough tomorrow, but, you know.
Sacrifices must be made.
Yeah.
I will start it soon. I don't want to start it tonight.
That's fair.
As I'm too scared.